What's Lost When a Language Dies? Only Our Grandchildren Will Know, by Leila Kopman. The story, at least so far, spans 3 decades and 3 continents. She came by plane, flying over the Pacific, leaving Tokyo behind. He came by ship, crossing the Atlantic, looking back at his home in Istanbul. Their paths would zig and zag until one day they would meet in, of all places, Ann Arbor, Michigan. Each brought a homeland. Each brought a native tongue. Yet they lived in a third land, communicated in a third language. And this third realm would become home, perhaps more home than the homes they left behind. And their unusual union would produce 2 children, a boy and a girl. They would know this place, America, as home. But they would know that part of them came from far-off corners they could scarcely imagine, let alone understand. These children would grow and think and learn. They would do this in English. The girl would grow up one day and visit the far-flung lands of her origins with her parents, at once learning about the histories of these foreign places and the histories of her foreign families. She would study languages herself, German, French, even a bit of Japanese, with varying degrees of proficiency. She would spend her days working on her English, not the grammar nor vocabulary, but the crafting of phrases. And she would find herself, one September afternoon, in a circle of 2 dozen high school students, trying to make the sounds of the ancient, sacred language of Dakota. Toked enisiapihe? What's your name? Our teacher, University of Minnesota instructor Neil McKay, is working through a list of Dakota language words and phrases, asking us to repeat them so we can practice the correct pronunciation. He says a word, Okana, which means grandfather, and asks us to say it back. The teenagers respond, as teenagers will, with barely audible mumbling. What is it about learning a language that's so very uncomfortable? It's like standing at the bottom of a craggy mountain. You understand everything here, right where you are. But if you start to climb into this unfamiliar territory, your thoughts must be compressed down into the skeletal language you possess. It's scary not to be able to say what you want or understand what's going on around you. But if you slowly, steadily climb the hill, the vista may be quite beautiful. Myself, this is my favorite part. Mimicking the unfamiliar sounds of a new language. Figuring out the architecture of a foreign grammar. Learning a rudimentary vocabulary. Some people like to solve riddles of logic or discover visual patterns. I like the puzzle of a new language. It's like unlocking a secret code that opens up an entirely new world of possibility. Yesterday you had no idea how to say cousin in Dakota, or window in French, or fish in Japanese. Today, you do. This is the fun stage before the struggle begins, as you try to really speak and listen and think and dream in this foreign tongue. This is long before the frustration hits, sparked because you don't know how to say anything more complicated than cousin or window or fish. Most of the teens sitting here were born a century after the Federal Indian Boarding School movement took off in the late 1870s. From then until 1920, and sometimes even later, Indian children were plucked from their homes and placed in government-run schools whose main mission was assimilation, or the civilizing of Indians to accept Christian values and speak English. They were forced to abandon their traditional ways of dress, their ceremonial and religious beliefs, and they were forbidden to speak their native languages. In many published accounts of their days in boarding schools throughout the country, Native Americans describe facing cruel punishment for breaking the English-only rules. Some recall being beaten, or spanked, or slapped with rulers. Others were made to live on only bread and water, or were locked in the school jail. Still, others had to brush their teeth with lye. As a result of this abuse and the prevailing notion that their own cultures and languages were somehow dirty and inferior, many of the students sent to boarding schools never became fluent speakers of their own language. They could not pass the language down to future generations. Even those who did retain their language skills often opted not to teach their children for fear that they would face the same discrimination Over the years, fewer and fewer American Indians learn to speak their own languages, and so it is that even generations later, these kids are suffering the consequences. Sitting at my right in the circle is Rebecca. She is 17 years old. She exudes 17-year-oldness, at once bubbly and shy, as eager to learn as she is to laugh. She wears low-cut jeans and black boots with a chunky high heel. Her chestnut hair is streaked with gold highlights, cropped close to her face to reveal multiple earrings. Her eyes are an unusual shade of bright violet, colored contact lenses, she explains. Purple is her favorite color. Rebecca is from the Flundra Reservation in South Dakota. She is one of a group of students from her high school that squished into a van and traveled 6 hours to attend this conference on the Dakota language at the University of Minnesota. The program, sponsored by the American Indian Studies Department, the nonprofit Grotto Foundation, and other organizations, hopes to raise awareness that it's now or never. Without concentrated efforts to promote and revitalize it, the ancient language could one day become extinct. In Minnesota, 7,541 people identified themselves as either Sioux or part Sioux, another name for Dakota, the people who first tended this land we call Minnesota today. Sioux includes Dakota, Lakota, and Nakota tribes. The Dakota language, as native tongues go, is fairly robust. There are 15,000 people with some Dakota language skills in the United States and 5,000 in Canada, according to Ethnologue, the publication of the language group SIL International. But there are less than 30 fluent speakers left in Minnesota's four Dakota communities. That figure does not account for people who speak the language less fluently, people who live in Minnesota outside their reservations, or Dakota speakers in other states and Canada. In any case, the numbers are small enough that the coordinators of the conference say it's time to take action to prevent this language from disappearing. And so this afternoon, we're sitting in a special workshop aimed at increasing the students' interest in learning Dakota. Most of them repeat in a monotone that they are here today to learn about their language and culture. Most of them know a little, but not much. Some of them aren't quite interested enough to come back to the classroom after a short break. We divide into smaller circles to work on sample dialogues. We go around the circle asking each other, "What's your name?" Rebecca writes out the phrases before she utters them, saying it helps her to see them on paper. She asks our teaching assistant how to pronounce certain words, how to form specific sentences. "Huh," she says, pleasantly surprised. "I guess I know more than I thought I did." Though Rebecca's father speaks Dakota, he didn't pass the language down to his children. She doesn't know why he didn't, but she'd like to learn more of the language now, to speak it with her little nephew so they can grow up with the language. But it's a challenge to find the time to take classes or speak with elders. "It's hard because I've been working and stuff," she admits. "They're looking to us as the next generation to keep this all going, and we don't even know our own language. We don't even know our own traditions." By the time this workshop is over, we've learned a few more phrases, going around the circle. "Toket en isiapie?" Rebecca asks me. "Leila emakiapie," I say, which means my name is Leila. "Tunintanhan hey?" "Where are you from?" "Bidiota hematanhan." "I'm from Minneapolis." We've learned that there are certain words that only men say, and some that only women say. For example, a man will call a male cousin Tahansi, but a woman will call a male cousin Ichesi. All in all, the afternoon lessons are an interesting exercise, offering the kids a tiny introduction to the language of their heritage. This workshop is heartening. All is not lost. But it's wistful too. Learning a few basic Dakota phrases is relatively simple. Reviving a threatened language is considerably harder. You've got to create the interest in learning the language. You've got to create an opportunity for immersion in the language in order to gain fluency. Only then can you start to think in that language, even dream in it. And in the case of Dakota and other indigenous languages, you've got to counteract hundreds of years of oppression and forced assimilation by the dominant culture. In the spring of 1993, my father and I went to Istanbul to visit his mother, my grandmother. On the plane, Dad picked up all the Turkish language newspapers he could find. After 31 years in the United States, he told me he had long since learned that in preparation for his annual visits to his homeland, he had to warm up his ability to speak and think in his mother tongue. With a Turkish vocabulary of about 5 words, most of them swear words, I had no such preparations to make. I was just a college student getting ready to spend the first 2 weeks of my summer vacation somewhere I hadn't been since I was a toddler, a place I really didn't know, but that was nonetheless a part of me. With the domes and spires of mosque dotting its hills, Istanbul was like no place I'd ever seen. Our trip was a whirlwind, a dizzy spin of Dad's family and friends, the sights of the ancient Ottoman Empire, stories about my dad's childhood, his studies at university, his years in the army. I would watch and listen as my father would chat and joke and laugh with his people, all in a language he never spoke to me, that I never understood. I would get lost in the gentle swirl of the Turkish language, floating on its melody without the slightest comprehension. But even so, this place was not totally strange. Sights we saw, foods we ate, people we met. These were all things that I'd grown up with, in some way, through the words and actions of my father. Now, having had a first-hand taste of this place that was both foreign and familiar, I was eager for a bigger bite. My grandmother was so excited to see me that she was all broad smiles and gentle embraces. I wondered how she could feel so connected to me when we couldn't even talk to each other. Yes, I was her granddaughter, but she didn't really know me at all. One afternoon I found myself alone with her in her parlor. Knowing that she spoke French, I tried to start a conversation. With all of 3 semesters of French under my belt, I could say things like, "It's a nice day," and "I'm cold," and "How are you?" Needless to say, the conversation was far from deep. But sometimes, the power of communication resides simply in sitting in the same room, together. After a sojourn in Istanbul, Dad went back to Minnesota and I went to Germany, where I was spending the summer working for a TV network. Immersed in German, my first foreign language, and incidentally my college major, my skills advanced significantly in 3 months. But by the time I returned to school in New York that fall, I was smitten with the idea of taking up Turkish. As I worked on fitting it into my schedule, I mentioned the idea to Dad. He grunted. "Don't do that. If you're going to take a new language, take something more useful, like Arabic." This was not the enthusiastic response I had anticipated. Perplexed, I dropped the idea. "Do you speak much Turkish?" I'm used to the question. It's usually one of the first ones asked when people learn of my heritage. This morning, the one posing the question is Gordon Reguinti, who, until recently, was the Native Language Initiative Coordinator for the Grotto Foundation, a St. Paul nonprofit that is in the first year of a 15-year plan to revitalize the languages indigenous to our region. "Do you want to learn?" Reguinti continues. "You need to make a concerted effort to create a situation where you can learn the language." He knows this from personal experience. Reguinti is Ojibwe, a member of the Leech Lake Band. He grew up on the reservation, where his grandparents routinely conversed in Ojibwe, which, with an estimated 35,000 living speakers in the United States and Canada, according to Ethnologue, is considered to be a little further from extinction than Dakota. "As a young boy, I was exposed to it, but the rest of my life was about learning English," Reguinti says. There are 2 ways to discourage learning a native language. There is the active, angry way. Move children from their homes to boarding schools, debase their language and culture, and beat them for failing to speak English. And there is the passive way. Create a society so dominated by the white man's culture that Native Americans must give up their language and take on English in order to survive. Both methods have left their legacy in Minnesota. In many cases, parents chose not to teach their children Dakota or Ojibwe to protect them from the discrimination they had endured. A noble idea, but the result is a crisis. If children do not learn their native tongue, what happens to their traditions, their ceremonies, their identities? Without the language, can the culture survive? Language defines one's world, Reguinti posits. In Ojibwe, these words communicate so much more. It's just not possible to express that in English. It helps to underscore our interconnectedness to all, our relationship to all. I can feel it, but I have no way to fully express it. But there is hope, he says. For elders, as they approach the end of the road, they look back and say they want to leave something. They're realizing it's the language they want to leave, says Reguinti, who is 47. Folks my age are realizing it's something I've missed in my life, something that I want to rediscover. So the efforts are expanding. There are immersion programs. In Pine County, for example, the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe have dedicated 67 acres to a camp where people can come to immerse themselves in the Ojibwe language through classes, traditional ceremonies, and seasonal work chores. In Shakopee, a Dakota elder is teaching a group of students the language so that they may go back into their communities and in turn teach other people. Around the state, plans are shaping up to create master apprentice programs where a student spends a set number of hours with a fluent speaker communicating only in Dakota or Ojibwe. The Grotto Foundation has set aside $5.6 million to fund programs that will preserve native languages and cultures. It's a relatively small amount of money, Regunti concedes, but hopefully the plan will at least plant the seeds for the tribal governments to kick in some resources. In time, Grotto plans to work in concert with other larger foundations that are promoting the same types of efforts around the country. Otherwise, in the long term, a grassroots effort can only go so far until you create a societal change, Regunti admits. Hopefully, a groundswell occurs that keeps moving it forward. I, personally, can sense it happening, he continues with a slight smile, but it's way beyond me, man. This is the end of part 1.